Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, we got Michael, and we're going to talk about, from 1995, the, I guess, definitive... You can lay it out, because you're the Austin expert on this one. Certainly more so than me. I know that's surprising, but...
What?
Yeah. But Pride and Prejudice from 1995, Colin Firth and, what's her name?
Jennifer Ely.
I couldn't remember her first name. Yeah, Jennifer Ely, who looks exactly like a young Meryl Streep.
Yes.
Exactly. I felt like I needed... That's my redemption. But you and Zach were both like, not really. And then later we're like, oh my God, you're right.
Hi. Yeah, I've never seen Meryl Streep young.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking of some movie like Sophie's Choice or something. Anyway, so Michael, you're the... You're the Austin expert, so as much a purist as I guess you would call yourself, right?
Yeah, definitely. I guess you saw my blog.
Right.
I'm definitely more of a purist than an enthusiast, that's for sure.
Now, explain that. Kind of get into it. Like, this is your time to really, like, cover this material, because I feel like you know more about it. You're definitely more literary. You've read stuff. I haven't read anything. I've just seen this once. You've seen it a couple of times. So set the context, set the tonality, and then eventually I think one thing I want to talk about is sort of I guess maybe feminism in the context of this story, and maybe in the greater context of the sort of these kinds of stories, I guess, if you will. Because it seems like there's a couple, like, I mean, the Bronte sisters did some stuff as well that may or may not be similar to someone who really knows this stuff. Maybe it's just a superficial thing, and I don't know any better. But I feel like that's kind of what I'd like to hit at with the podcast. So please give us a survey course on Jane Austen, if you don't mind.
That is... a tall order.
Well, you can keep it focused on this, I guess, on Pride and Prejudice specifically, maybe, and what you mean when you say that you're a purist versus someone who might be an enthusiast.
So I just recently came to this realization. I always kind of took myself for an enthusiast and not really a purist. And what I mean by enthusiast is someone who is just super enthusiastic about Jane Austen in general. Like, they will take any Jane Austen in any form. And I should have known back when, what's that director's name that did it with Keira Knightley?
I was familiar with that movie. I remember when it came out, but I don't know the director's name.
He did Atonement and stuff. Anyway, and I didn't enjoy, and I knew I wouldn't enjoy the Keira Knightley version because, I mean, if you've grown up with the 95 version, then that's just sort of the one. And Mr. Darcy is always going to be Colin Firth.
Now, is that just kind of like a almost like general consensus among people that of all the derivations of this story put to, you know, to visual media or whatever, that this miniseries, this 5-part thing made in 95 is kind of the definitive, purest, best version of the story?
It is. In fact, I read an article on the AV Club about the series on Masterpiece that I was complaining about in my blog. It's called Death Comes to Pemberley. And this was sort of a review of Death Comes to Pemberley, as well as a look at Pride and Prejudice over the years. When I came to this realization, basically, like, I have a friend who loved Death Comes to Pemberley. She loved this one from a few years back called Lost in Austin. And they're basically like fans sort of taking Pride and Prejudice to the next level. And I thought both of them were pretty atrocious. And so that is when I realized I'm more of a purist for sure than an enthusiast. And this article was also talking about how Andrew Davies' script for this 5-hour version of Pride and Prejudice only really leaves out a couple of scenes from the book. I mean, it is that thorough. So if you're looking for the best possible adaptation, this is going to be it.
The most, like you said, the most thorough, maybe. Or now, just to sort of lay it out, is this a particularly long book? Because, I mean, it's one thing, obviously, having 5 hours is certainly... you're going to have the time to do more than you would in, say, just a general feature adaptation that might be 2 or 2.5 hours, only half the length. So I mean, the question then becomes, like, I mean, if it's a 300-page book, to do it in 5 hours and get almost all of it, that's not too unheard of. But if it's like a 800-page book with way more characters or something, then maybe it is. But
No, it's not a long book. It's 300, maybe 400 pages. And that's why I say, or and why that article brought up that this is the most accurate version, because a 300-page book in 5 hours, like I said, there are only really a couple of scenes in the book where I was like, oh, that wasn't in the miniseries.
do you think that that was omitted for pacing, or I mean, what are those scenes? What do they amount to? Are they just further emphasizing a point that we already kind of get if we're watching the story unfold?
Well, basically, I mean, even a 300-page book isn't going to fit into 5 hours neatly. So there's a couple of scenes. One I remember in particular because it struck me as being very human is one after she realizes that she likes Mr. Darcy and she's trying to get his attention. And it's just kind of typical of what a girl would do to get a guy's attention when he's ignoring them. And so it's just a little scene like that. Obviously doesn't necessarily add anything to the story. It's just kind of a nice scene to realize that women back in 1815 are the same as women of today.
Right, yeah. And that, okay, that is good. Yeah, because I was kind of curious watching it, like, when is this? Is this, relative, to U.S. history or anything? Like, is this post-Civil War? Is this pre? But 1815, wow, that's really quite a long time ago. I thought it
Yeah,
was more like
crazy.
1870 or something, maybe, but.
I think she started writing. I think she published her first book in 1811, and yeah, only wrote a few.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, there hadn't been that many novels at that point, probably.
Ah, well, that's a whole other
Yeah, right, exactly.
that's a whole other discussion.
Okay, so lay it out for us. What's really going on in this story, and how is the sort of how does it either accurately or romantically, depict sort of the reality for these types of people that it's telling a story about?
She's seen as very much a romantic kind of writer from today's standards. And I think a lot of people can either take it two ways. They can go with the, it's not very accurate. It's very much romanticized. A woman of that era would not be able to choose a husband for love, let alone one with money. So there's that aspect of it, but that at the same time, at that period of history, a woman would never even think to turn a man down, I guess. And so from that perspective, they can also be seen as kind of radical.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's definitely things about the and then you talk about in terms of the adaptation, like all of the character behavior is not being f I mean, Davies isn't who also wrote like you said the original House of Cards. He isn't filtering it through sort of a modern sensibility about character behavior, is he? I mean, it's really kind of like this is the way it was written, and this is where we're at, right?
Davies for sure isn't. Like if you read the book in conjecture with the mini series, it is like really, really spot on. If any filter is given to it, it would be from the actors. I think Jennifer Ely sort of gives Lizzie more attitude, perhaps, than she had in the book itself. So I think you kind of have to take that into context. I
Right,
think
that's a little modern there than, yeah.
not that what she said is different. Like what she said is the same as in the book, but in the book, you get the sense that she is saying something subversive, but she's saying it respectfully, so they can't really tell.
Okay, right. So I mean, it's sort of a dramatic li there's an element of dramatic license there to kind of make it more intense, I guess.
Yeah,
Right.
and I think it's most noticeable with Jennifer Ely. The first time I watched it wasn't the first version of Pride and Prejudice I saw. The first one was the 1940s version with Laurence Olivier and Greer Garson. And Greer Garson, in my mind, And I think even the article said this, that Greer Garson was the epitome of what Lizzie should be. She was witty, she was smart, but she was polite. She still worked within her society, and no one could really come down on her for being this girl with attitude because she said everything properly. It was just what she said wasn't necessarily what they agreed with.
Oh, she was at the paramount of tact then, huh?
Right. Right. So it's one of those things. There are like good and bad things about each version. The best thing about the 1940s version, like I said, Greer Garson is the perfect Lizzie. But then this version has the perfect Darcy. So,
well, okay, then.
Kind of balances out. Right. 1815, yeah, Regency era. So hopefully anyone who listens to this is familiar with this story, and I'm not spoiling any of the fun. But
It's an old enough story. It's an old enough story, plus the actual thing was made in 95, so we've got almost 20 years there. So, yeah. And a lot more the other way.
Although I did show it to some girls who were like, why does everyone like Mr. Darcy? He's such a jerk. And then they get to the end of their life, I love Mr. Darcy. Aww. So so hopefully everyone's seen it. But it's basically a story about these five girls, the main one being the not the eldest, but the second from the eldest. They're basically too poor to marry well.
But in the context, they're like actually pretty well off. I think the term Zach was saying when we watched one, because he was familiar with the show and he has two sisters, and his sisters and his mom will watch it every year or whatever. He's like, they're landed gentry, so they don't really do anything.
Right. Yeah. They don't have any money though.
Right. They have no, and because it's daughters, there's no, it's like there's no dowry or I don't know, something like to that equivalent, right? So it's kind of hard to pawn them off, as it were.
Exactly. So basically how I see them is lower middle class.
That makes sense in the context of the story for sure.
Yeah. So they would be like, and maybe this is part of why it's so, her stuff is so popular, is I can identify with that. I'm from a lower middle class family. I personally struck out on my own. I have no money. I've got $40 in the bank, you know? And so there's all this that goes into it. Yeah. They're landed gentry. Yeah. They're not like servants.
Right.
But for the era and the time, we'll say lower middle class. And because of that, they have no options other than they have to marry, and they have to marry who asks them.
Right. Because so they're looking to get good asks, and that's basically where it's at, right?
They're hoping to get someone with money, but they could, the mom clearly could care less who they marry, as long as they're married. And because basically what happens is whoever the male heir is to their house when the dad dies gets the house. And right. The girls and the mom are out on the street. Unless whoever the male heir is kind enough to take them in. So basically, unless all five girls are married, by the time the dad dies, there's nothing for them to do.
It is sort of an interesting context for all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, this isn't mine? What do you mean?
So it's kind of like, so the mom is always treated as this kind of crazy person. And she is. She's like totally wacky, but within good reason. I mean, if the dad dies, there are five girls. Her five girls and herself have nothing. Because they're just kicked off of the house that they were raised in and born in. And
yeah, that definitely puts a much more dire kind of context into the whole thing.
I keep saying
context, but I think it's important for me, at least viewing this, to kind of get a sense of why some of these things are as important as they are. Because when you look at it from modern eyes, it just seems like it's very I don't know, trivial or something. You know, like, well, yeah. What does it matter? But it's like, well, no, this is why it matters, because this is these people's, like, you know, livelihood or whatever.
And I don't know if you remember, but we've talked about it before, and I went through. You told me to give you...
Yeah, I remember you had told me sort of the general plot synopsis, and so I remembered bits and pieces, and as I was watching it, I was like, I think this is the thing you told me about.
And you were like, Darcy's a jerk. Why should she want to marry him? Because he went and had her sister marry this other asshole. And I was like, you don't understand the time
Right, yeah.
frame.
No, well, I still think that was more, I feel like in the context of this of the movie or of the miniseries, they established that was it Lydia, the youngest, who just deserves whatever happens to her, man. She's not a good person. Which does seem a little weird, but maybe because being the youngest, she might have gotten the most of her mother in her. I don't know what would that would, and the least of her father, maybe, because he was kind of done for. He seemed just kind of wiped out at the end.
I
Five
think
girls, huh?
every time you get to the youngest child, you're like, whatever, do whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I mean, in the context, once again, it seems like where she's run off with this scumbucket type guy, that yeah, that locking something in that is essentially a contract, is actually pretty important in that case, you know. So I it's yeah, like I think that it makes more sense when you actually do see it unfold in the way the story does it. Though that is one of my sort of few criticisms of the story, is that they don't actually show that confrontation on screen between Darcy and Wickham, the guy that basically, goes after the 16-year-old Lydia.
Well, that's because it's from Lizzie's perspective, and Lizzie doesn't know, so you don't know.
That's true. I mean, there are moments in the story, or in the I mean, I don't know if in the story, but in the miniseries, that are from Darcy's perspective. But yeah, for the most part, it's Lizzie's story. It's her perspective, and so her not knowing these things, or when she learns them, is is important. I mean, though I don't know that they couldn't have taken some dramatic license and let the audience know a little before she does. That's a different way you can play it. But like I said, that's just a creative choice that I don't think completely undermines or does anything there. So it's a pretty minor criticism. So you've got Jane, the oldest one, and there's this kind of easygoing, carefree, wealthy guy that seems pretty smitten with Jane. And like most carefree guys, he's got sort of a misanthropic buddy that he keeps around, probably to keep him grounded. He's smart enough to do that, you know. He's like, oh, I'm potentially the kind of guy that's like, gonna give all my money to the wallet inspector, so I need a friend of mine to tell me that the wallet inspector doesn't exist, you know. And that guy, the misanthropic sort of gruff fellow, is Darcy, and that introduces the context for Darcy meeting Lizzie, the second oldest, who's the protagonist of the story, I guess. And then they have various balls and parties where they interact. And I feel like it's tough to nail his character down from the get-go, because in the old adage, it's, really pretty straightforward. I mean, women make their mind up about men pretty quickly, and they're not quick to change it. And when she first meets him, he's really not very cool to her, even though it's like he's at a dance, but he's and then they're like, oh, hey, you guys should dance, and he's like, I don't want to do that, but he does it like in a much more assholish way. which just kind of seems like, well, why is he even here? What's the I guess his character is a bit more inscrutable at the beginning, because you're just not really sure what he is doing. And sure, some of it eventually kind of starts to feel or become kind of like the grammar school pigtail pulling type of stuff, where it's like he likes her, but he doesn't want her to know, but whatever. But you kind of wonder, did that happen initially with him, or was there something he saw in a certain way? It seems fairly superficial initially, and obviously, the more chances they get to kind of interact, and he sees her with other people, and he sees the way other people treat her, and the way she responds to that, both fairly gracefully but also assertively. I think that there's when there's sort of some legitimacy to the idea of there being a real attraction, at least from his perspective. Now, for her perspective, it's always more about things other people tell her about him, like, oh, he does this and he does that, and he's actually a pretty affable guy when he's at home, you know, doing his own thing or whatever. Right. And she's like, I don't believe it, but then I guess she sees it, and at some point he does just become more friendly in a strange way. And maybe it's just a different world like we live in now. People are much quicker to kind of dismiss people off of first impressions or bad moments or whatever, because there's just that many more fish in the sea, because of the ability to kind of access these things. So I don't know. I mean, how do you feel? Do you feel like the romance of the story is fairly authentic? I mean, you have a better understanding of the time period, and so I'm sure that it's hard for me, not knowing that stuff, to kind of be able to completely divorce myself from kind of modern sensibilities about the idea of two people falling in love.
I don't know that any I could speak to that, because I mean, who knows? I don't think it's fiction. Yeah,
you weren't alive then, right?
I wasn't alive then. Does Mr. Darcy exist in real life? No.
but there's that sort of, I think if we boil it down to like personality types, there's that sort of personality for certain people that are kind of almost like he's got, I mean, like sort of a social anxiety, and you see it in Firth's performance a lot, in the way that they enter a room, they do the like hello bow thing, and then he immediately goes to like the window and just looks out the window. He really is not comfortable being in these rooms where people are supposed to have kind of pleasant conversation. It's he's a little bit aloof in that kind of I don't want to be here sort of way. That, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's just alluring to her, or I don't know. I mean, it clearly offends some of them. It offends the mother. It offends other people that he's not sort of more engaging. Yeah, I mean, so I'm not sure. Her character is great. Like, I think from that perspective, like, especially understanding where everything is and what she has to lose, and kind of this sense of responsibility to her family and, you know, to get married and all these other things. She's, I think a lot of that comes from, you get in the way that her father treats her, and he has sort of I mean, beyond just like sort of the fatherly love for her, I think he has kind of a higher respect for her, because he can see that she's got a greater intelligence and wit than most of her sisters. Mm-hmm. though Jane seems to be pretty sharp too. Just in watching it, I didn't really notice the middle two much. But there's is it Mary? They have Mary in there as the example of the one that's just going to read books and doesn't give a shit about any of the stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that one. Like, I'm like, I wonder if she ever did a spin-off story just about her being an old maid and like not caring. But yeah, so I mean, so the way the story unfolds, you've got kind of a lot of interactions that are tested, and then at some point he decides he likes her and kind of just throws it out there, which I think was sort of the way it was back then, right? It's like, you know, hey, I like you, you should marry me.
Yeah. What is that? That's after she gets proposed to by...
Oh, right, the churchly guy.
Yeah, right? And he's there for like how long, and he's popping the question to her, and he comes there for the purpose of, oh, speaking of what, he's the one that gets the house,
right? Yeah,
Collins, Mr. Collins. So he's the one that gets the house when the dad dies, so he's going there to propose to one of the five daughters, which is of course considered like a very selfless thing for him to do,
except that, yeah, I mean, but the, I mean, you know,
yeah, but it's Mr. Collins.
Right, yeah. Granted, I did watch this. I wasn't like, you know, doing other things while it was on, but I have no doubt that I'm sure I missed a handful of things in the 5 hours of it. So I got the sense that he's like a clergyman, but he actually like has the deed to their house, or, I mean, how does that play out, that where he has essentially ownership after the death? That's regardless of whether he's married to one of them or anything, right?
He's their cousin, so I don't know.
Okay, it boils down into some sort of involved, raveled family thing then.
Exactly. Whatever it works out to be, he's the net, the
The next
most senior
male, right.
male in the family. So when Mr. Bennett dies, Collins gets the house.
Okay. And yeah, and Bennett is this sort of family name. It's Lizzie Bennett and the Bennett sisters and all that. Those are the main characters. Okay. Yeah, right. So then after that happens.
And I've seen it probably like 30 times, I'm not gonna lie. And the more you watch it, like, I don't know if you noticed this, but the way they played it is Mary is actually quite keen on Mr. Collins.
Really?
It's really cute and kind of disappointing that he doesn't ask her because she is obviously quite taken with him.
I don't know how anyone would be. The way I get it is just from the get-go is that he just seems so kind of greasy and creepy and sort of like there's nothing appealing about the guy. He doesn't seem like a nice guy doing a selfless act or anything. I mean, it's one thing to just be kind of a ordinary looking fellow just doing things, but I don't know, it seems to me like he's kind of antagonistic and you never really like the character much. You feel like he kind of gets what he deserves when he marries that other lady and she just kind of puts him in the garden and whatever, yeah.
I mean, he's not a character that you're supposed to like. They just sort of chose that Mary would like him. And it's not, in context. It's not in the book or anything, but the actress just sort of played it so that you can tell that she's keen on him. And if you watch her in the background, which I tend to do now when I watch the show, you can see that she like pays attention to him more than anyone else does, and she'll like engage with him. And so that's like the thing. She likes his learning, I guess.
Ah, okay.
She can talk to him.
As long as there's a rationale, that's always what I'm searching for in stories, as it were, especially stories about characters that have tumultuous relationships.
But yeah, you're not supposed to like him. I mean, when he later on, when Lydia runs off with Mr. Wickham and he says it would have been better if she died, then
Yeah, it gets pretty extreme there, and it's like, oh my God, this is a scandal and blah blah. I mean, I think though that still reads pretty strongly in this era because she's so young.
And I mean, it would have, I mean, you have to put yourself back in 1815. She was having sex with a man that she was not married to.
Right. Well,
So,
that's also very subtextual too. They never really out and out say anything like that, but you—that's what you have to infer given the time. No one's going to speak like that.
yeah, no one's going to say that out loud. No, but I mean, it's fairly obviously she ran away thinking with him, thinking that they were going to get married, and they did not get married. And had she been returned to them, unmarried still, it's basically a taint on their entire family.
Damaged goods kind of thing, right?
She's damaged goods, and if they can't control their youngest, then who knows what the four oldest are up to.
Ah, right. See, so th this always this helps because in some cases it seems very hyperbolic, but then when you get all the pieces put together, it really does end up working fairly well and making a lot more sense and being pretty good in that respect. I still feel like I don't get, other than like the obvious, I don't get what m makes Darcy so drawn to her initially in the way that he immediate pretty quickly is. And then I mean, what is it? It's the third part that he basically proposes to her. I'm just not, I'm not sure if maybe I'm mixing up all the different balls and interactions or what, but I mean, she comes to visit something, but they haven't had their. She hasn't seen his house yet. That happens in part four. When
I
that happens.
always took it as he's a smart guy, and when he comes to the ball, he's like, yeah, she's pretty, I guess, but not pretty enough to force me to dance. But then as he, I mean, he, she is living with them basically when Jane is sick and she goes to visit. And she won't take any of his guff, basically. She stands up to him and she's smart. So I feel like that is the main draw, is that she is not some woman that's going to simper and smirk and be like.
Yeah, she lays it out in the open, like pretty effectively, which I think, yeah, you're right. I'd forgotten that part about the fact that it's not his house. It's the guy.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's, I mean, but it's that he's there too is kind of odd,
he's
but it's
being there.
Yeah.
With them for this period of time, because traveling was a much more arduous thing than it is now. So
for sure, yeah.
When he's going to go out of town, he's going to go out of town for quite some time, and they have these huge estates. So he's effectively like living with Bingley. And so when Jane and Lizzie come, they are living with them as well. And I don't remember how long, but it's for quite a long time. It's at least 2-3 weeks, maybe a month.
Yeah, I think it's at least a couple of weeks. And that's, like you said, enough time to have a few back and forths and interactions.
You only get a taste of it. There's the scene where her and Miss Bingley, the sister, are making their turn about the room, and they invite Mr. Darcy to come with, or Miss Bingley does. And he says that would defeat the purpose. Like that whole scene is just one night. And if she stayed with them at least 2 weeks, every night she was required to go down and spend time with them.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, sure, you don't see it. You don't necessarily witness every single night when she comes down and they probably have some kind of witty banter, you know. But that's going on. And so it's very conceivable to me that he would follow.
The trick is that they were forced to have to hang out for a while.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. And then I feel like the question then, and this is maybe where we can get a little more into that, maybe into some questions of feminism or whatever, is I'm never sure what really gets her into him. And they actually talk about it pretty explicitly in the final episode where, I mean, you know, she's talking with her dad and he's like, are you sure? Like, for a while there's like this running joke of like people think that she's gonna marry this guy, and everyone's like, oh my god, can you believe that? What a joke that would be. And
yeah.
Which is also kind of funny given the context of like, no, wait, that'd be a real boon for the family and, you know, everything else. But they're kind of over that now, maybe because the older sister has married this other guy, is going to be marrying this other guy, and things are going to just, I guess that, does that kind of solve the kind of like overhanging problem for the story at that point? So that it's like now the rest of them are kind of free to essentially marry for love or live the lives they'd want to live because Jane happens to, just through also sort of romantic good luck, be getting together with a guy who's going to take very good care of her and her family.
Yeah. All it takes is the one, and he is considered wealthy, right?
He's considered pretty up there. Yeah.
So as long as there is like if she had married Mr. Collins, they necessarily wouldn't have been out of the woods. They would have been okay. Like things would have been all right. They would have probably been able to stay in their house. Like things would have been all right. But because she marries someone with money, then they are definitely like, they're out of the woods. But again, that doesn't happen till the end. They aren't out of the woods till the last episode.
Right. Yeah. So there's not a lot of time. I guess in a weird way, it feels kind of like a rushed third act a little bit. In terms of getting all the pieces together in the context of the romance, which I view as kind of being the main plot, I guess, of the story. I mean, sure, it's a story with, you know, it's an ensemble cast and different things happening. But like you said, Lizzie is the protagonist. It's from her perspective, and it's her navigating these different people in her life and in her world, and arriving at this one person. And in that sense, I don't know, it still seems really tricky. Like, it's one thing to have done, you know, to be like, oh, wow, he did this self, not the selfless thing necessarily, but I mean, he kind of took on this financial burden and sort of helped her family without any real instigation. But at the same time, like, he had already proposed to her, like, he already kind of wanted something from her.
Well, yeah.
So doing this, but he tried to keep it on the sly, but it was never his own fault, you know, like, he didn't, like, reveal it and use it as leverage to try to manipulate her into agreeing.
Okay, stop talking. Okay. Now let's go back here. He proposed to her, she turned him down.
Right.
She didn't just turn him down, she turned him down, like, and insulted him.
Right.
So he is doing this without the hope that she is going to marry him.
Okay. I still feel like historically, though, like that's not enough. Maybe that she turned him down now, but like, I don't know. If it's weird, it's like a weird sort of dual thing going on there, where it's like her say matters, but her say kind of doesn't matter ultimately. I mean, sure, it matters, but, like, I feel like it's something that you could be more dismissive of in that era because of everything else that's going on. Like, that he could be like, oh, sure, you reject me now, but, you know, we'll see how things are doing for you and your family in a couple weeks. And
yeah, but not him. Like, you could say that about Mr. Collins. He does.
Right.
He literally says that. But
you at least get from the get-go that Darcy has enough sort of integrity and self-respect as a person that is going to be like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Collins doesn't. He thinks, oh, she's turning him down because she's a woman. And that's what they do. Increase their affection. And Darcy not only knows that Lizzie would not play that game, but he's also, like you said, a man of integrity who said her no means no. And that's why at the end, when he does propose, he's like, I don't want to hope, but you seem to have changed your attitude towards me. So yeah, I mean, I can see, like, if this was Mr. Collins and he went off and did this thing for Wickham, sure, but because it's Darcy, and that's what makes the act as noble as it is, and what makes Mr. Darcy go down in women's history of romantic men, is that he does this without the hope that Lizzie would ever actually marry him.
I think the big thing that certainly dissuaded her from any sort of interest in him is the idea that he talked his friend out of marrying her sister, which would have, like I said, which then ultimately ends up happening, but like would have been this, you know, the huge saving grace for it. So he doesn't deny it at the time, he says, and kind of lays it out in I feel, a fairly progressive way, where, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like he felt like he was kind of doing her a favor, because he thought, and ultimately his friend, like, he felt, I guess he interpreted their interaction between Jane and his friend, Bingley, as being, like, Bingley really liked her, but he felt like she was a little cold on him, maybe not as into him as he was to her. And is that pretty accurate for his rationalization, you think?
Yeah.
So in that sense, he was trying to do right by his friend, and in sort of a way do right by Jane as well, you know? Like, I don't think either one of them is going to ultimately be in a very good place if they get together. And then that's kind of hand waved off later, but ultimately he cops to saying he just misread the situation.
Right.
And I'm not sure what that amounts to. If there's a good rationalization there for if he just, you know, Jane is just the kind of person that doesn't smile a lot or or whatever it is. But so in that sense, then he kind of cops to his mistake, and there's a lot of arc for his character, you know, going from being so prideful to kind of learning to admit his faults and his mistakes. And I think even proposing to Lizzie early like he does is kind of shows a definite vulnerability. That was an interesting kind of thing, because it's not all about her trying to find being into him and doing whatever she can to get him to notice her or whatever. It's more her doing right by her family in terms of just, you know, wanting to take care of her sisters and everything else. And that seems to be her primary concern, which makes her a character that's easy to like beyond just her, you know, wittiness and her ability to stand up to the jerks of this world. Yeah. She sincerely cares about her family, and that's, I think, you know, ultimately like a good thing for the story and for the character, and it makes it like a higher quality story. You were surprised, I think, because you were like, wait, you're watching another one? I mean, I found it to be kind of almost marathonable. I mean, it's no Attack on Titan, but, you know, it's marathonable to a degree. I mean, because it does kind of keep going, and it's sort of, you know, if you're watching it like on a Sunday night, just kind of taking it easy, having your dinner, you know, you might watch one or two or three or whatever, and that's how I did it. I think I did the first three, and then I just did one, and Zach and I hung out, and then I finished it off the following Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, I definitely liked it. I mean... And I mean, you. I think another thing that's interesting is you get probably the best interaction, not necessarily the best interaction, but sort of one of the most, certainly the most directly confrontational scenes is between Lizzie and the old bag,
Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Yeah, who is sort of the chief matriarch of Darcy's family.
Yes.
You know, much in that sort of way that, as yeah, it's all about patriarchy and legally and everything, but at the end of the day, it's usually some old lady that kind of is running the show behind the scenes. and her going, I mean, it's an interesting way to frame it too, because, and I'll ask you this, but where do you think Lizzie's affection for Darcy really turns full into, like, I would marry this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, because there's the three things that happen, I would say, with her turn and her turn from disliking. I mean, she fully dislikes the guy when it's like, hey, he talked his friend out of marrying her sister, and now he's out of the blue proposing to her, and she's like, what? You know, you think I'm cool. I know I'm cool. You're an asshole. I don't care about you. Go die in a ditch. And like, that was boom. That was pretty good stuff. But then everything after, so that's kind of like the midpoint of the story. And then everything after that is all these kind of other things happening with the characters around her, and then him taking certain actions. But I guess the first thing is kind of the house thing, which is apparently some kind of big, it's like the most provocative scene of the story or something like that. So there's the house. There's there's her learning about what he did for her family vis-a-vis, you know, strong arming Wickham into marrying Lydia, the youngest sister. And also, I guess, kind of settling whatever debts would be involved in that and kind of taking on the financial burden of that. And then I think the third thing is the confrontation with Lady Catherine that Lizzie has, where Lady Catherine's like, we hear, you know, word around the campfire is that you and Darcy, he's thinking about, or you're thinking about, like, she's like, that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think in those three things? I mean, obviously the buildup adds more to it, but do you think that she's not kind of fully decided that she loves this guy and would want to marry him until after that interaction with Catherine?
Because
that certainly adds an extra wrinkle of almost kind of like spitefulness there, you know?
I would say after she's found out what he did for her family is when she's like, oh, okay. But she doesn't think he's going to ask again. So when Lady Catherine comes around, she's like, no, we're not getting married. But if he asked me again, would I say no? No, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction. And which, of course, gives him hope. I would have said the three things would be, one, him telling her what Wickham had done to his family, because obviously that's a huge deal.
Right,
if,
yeah.
If basically any association with Wickham is going to taint a family, him telling her that huge secret is a big deal. And that's when she starts to realize that she's been prejudiced towards him. So I would say that was number one. Number two is going to his house and having the maid be like, oh, he's the best little boy, and he was so nice, and just like da-da-da-da-da. And then he comes around, and he's like not this proud, arrogant jerk that she sees in public, but he's at ease and, you know, like someone she could feasibly love because
he's home.
Yeah, because he's at home.
Yeah, that part's always funny to me. It's like, of course he's going to be easier going. He's at home. We didn't expect there'd be people at his house, like, taking a tour.
And then the third thing to me would be the whole, when she finds out the whole Lydia thing. And then I would say at that point, she's like, okay.
That's true. Awesome. I'd forgotten that first initial, like, his rebuff of Wickham's statements, you know, when he just sort of puts it in a letter. He's like,
yeah, and I would say that the incident with Lady Catherine is what gets him to propose again, which that is the incident that gives him hope that she would say yes, because she flatly refused to say that she would say no.
Right, yeah, which like I said, it's still fairly complicated, because her character is just complex enough that you can see her, you know, even if she would say no, still kind of jerking the old lady around about it. Because, like, who's that old lady to tell her what to do, you know, at all? Which is absolutely right.
Because Lizzie is honest. So she doesn't like Lady Catherine. If she doesn't want to marry Mr. Darcy, she's going to flat out tell her she doesn't want to marry her nephew, no matter how good he is. Because Lady Catherine's going to take that as a total effrontery, because what woman would not want to marry her nephew?
That's a good point. You're right. You're right. So this is a good study in kind of understanding other frames of reference and perspectives on things.
Yeah. Total. And that's why, because Darcy knows her well enough that if she was totally set against marrying him, she would have told Lady Catherine that. And right, because she doesn't, he's like, oh, maybe she's changed her mind. Maybe I should ask again.
And then you arrive at that. And so, yeah, it's a pretty well-structured story, I think.
It is very well-structured.
I feel like it seems a little rushed towards the latter portion. And that maybe there's some stuff in the middle that they could have possibly removed or something. But, I mean, like, if you're trying to shrink it down, but it's not like any of it drags or is any real... I don't feel like there's any real slogging, dragging portions of the story. It does feel like there's a lot of balls that get gone to and people hanging out playing the piano, but that's kind of just the framework for the interactions to occur a lot of times.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, like I said, the one scene that I described to you was towards the end. It was after she realized she loved him and she wanted to get his attention.
I feel like that would have been maybe a good scene for this to be in the story, because you would have felt more actualization from her about actually maybe pursuing this romantic interest. A lot of it feels like it comes from outside of her. I mean, just in the description of the four things, it has more to do with things he does and he says and people, things that people do or say to her, than her own kind of like decisive action about, like, you know, being interested in the guy. So, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that that's in the actual story. I think, and I feel like that's a weird thing for them to maybe have omitted from this story, from this adaptation. Where do you stand on it?
Part of the problem is it's a fantastic scene in the book. It's absolutely fabulous, which is why I remember it so well. The problem is that the story, even though it's an omniscient narrator, it is told from Lizzie's perspective. And so the whole scene, there's nothing she says. And I find that this is commonly the hardest part about adapting books to film, is when it is all internal. So she, the whole scene plays out. This is around the time when him and Bingley come back and Bingley comes to propose to Jane. So it's sometime around then she's found out about everything and he's come back and they come over to visit the family. And, all she can think is, how do I get his attention? Oh, I know, I'll serve tea. You know, like if I serve him tea, then he'll have to like look at me or something like that. You know, and it's all in her head. There's nothing in the scene.
Right. It's all internal monologue type stuff.
Right. It's like how people are always like, oh, Dune is such a horrible adaptation because everything is spoken like telepathically. You know, so it's the same thing. The whole scene is very much inside her head. And how could she get his attention? She'll serve him tea. Oh, she'll do this. Like, oh, why isn't he looking at her? Like, it's very much. And that's why I love the scene. It's very much what women go through when they like someone. But it would not play well on screen.
I feel like they hint at bits of that, and maybe that's why they didn't ultimately try it. Because I mean, you could have there's a lot of nonverbal stuff that she does and that he does, both in their interactions with each other and just in their interactions with people there in the story that work. I mean, like, you do get that sense of there being kind of an interesting tension there between the two of them when they're in the room with this other stuff happening. So maybe they felt they just didn't need it.
Yeah.
Or like you said, it would be tricky. It would be tricky because you'd have to just have her like either there'd be the temptation to just have her like verbalize it to one of her sisters, you know, like it'd be a funny scene. It'd be like something out of like True Detective or something where she'd like verbalize it all to Mary. And then Mary would just be like, look, you have to understand. I really don't care about any of this. Like this doesn't mean anything to me. And I'm not interested in what you're saying to me right now. But that's a whole different kind of thinking about it.
I think you're right. I think part of it might be Andrew Davies was adapting it and he was like, this is going to be hard to adapt to screen. So we'll just skip it without, oops. Oh shoot.
You okay? Do you need to take a break?
No.
Okay.
Without realizing the talent that he had, I think, like, or I mean, because obviously he probably wrote it before they had cast.
Right, yeah. I feel like that cast could have pulled off a pretty decent nonverbal thing.
Well, because there's the whole, like, I don't even know. There's that whole moment when Lizzie, and this is, like, the infamous, one of the more infamous scenes, along with him coming out of the lake with a wet shirt. I can't remember. She's at Pemberley, she's visiting, and Miss Bingley is talking about Wickham, and Darcy's sister like stops playing the piano, and Lizzie goes over and is like, oh, how can you play without someone to you know, change the music for you? And she looks up and she looks across the room and she looks at Darcy, and there Darcy looks back at her. And in that moment, I mean, Firth is amazing. And he just, like, there is a softening in his look and his expression that is so incredibly subtle, and you just know what he's thinking.
Wait, no, this is in the context of him and his relationship to his sister playing music with her?
The fact that Lizzie went up, now that she knows the history of what happened with Georgiana and Mr. Wickham, and Miss Bingley doesn't know, obviously, because she's callous enough to bring up Mr. Wickham in conversation in front of Georgiana.
Right.
And obviously, this is a very still sensitive issue for her. So Lizzie comes to the rescue by going over to Georgiana and sort of just being this comforting presence.
Right. Okay. Now that makes sense. And then she sees that in that moment that yes, that he's like, okay, that was nice of you. Thank you. You know.
Yeah, and his absolute, like, I mean, his look is just absolutely adoring of Lizzie in that moment. And I feel like only Colin Firth could pull that off. And had maybe Andrew Davies realized that he was working with Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely, then maybe they would have kept that scene in because they said so much in looks in just that one scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. Well, I mean, thanks for kind of helping me talk with this. I was never really sure what I would make of it, but I have a greater appreciation of it now having seen it, but also having talked with you more about it and having you kind of lay out some of the aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think I do see it, because it's still ultimately her choices, it's her actions that kind of determine the outcome of the story. I don't feel like she's ever pressured. I don't feel like it's a social consideration that there. So in that sense, I don't know. I feel like it's a pretty progressive story about a sort of female protagonist. And it crazy is as hell that it was written in 1812, you know?
Yeah, it's incredibly progressive for its time period. And people forget that with Jane Austen. They say, oh, like, she's just romantic. But it was incredibly progressive that this character not only married someone that she loved, but married above her station.
Wow. I wonder if that helped with because it was popular enough to still exist now. This is, you know, and have been adapted many times and everything else.
Bridget Jones' Diary is an adaptation of it.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll have to check that out just to see how that works as a modern adaptation. I've only seen trailers, and I don't get it. I don't remember feeling like there was other sisters, or I mean, is it like a pretty loose?
Yeah, yeah. It's just her. Hugh Grant is basically the Wickham character. Colin Firth is the Mr. Darcy character.
Again, huh?
In a meta sort of, and actually, in the book itself, what's her name? Fielding, I think, talks about how perfect Colin Firth is as Mr. Darcy. The character of Pride and Prejudice. So to get Colin Firth then to play the Mr. Darcy of Pride and Prejudice is pretty funny.
Right, he does do that kind of like, ultimately he's a good guy, but he comes off kind of gruff and asshole-ish thing pretty well, doesn't he?
He does.
He's that way in the King's Speech, you know, where, you know, you just think, God, this guy's so full of it. And like, yeah, so he stutters, so whatever. But then you see the whole story play out and you get a sense of his responsibilities and his interaction with his father and with his brother. It really does become a much more complex story.
He's a fantastic actor. I absolutely love him. And people rave about Benedict Cumberbatch, and I do love Benedict. But, and there was this picture that he redid the scene of coming out of the water. And people were like, oh, sorry, you know, move aside Colin Firth. And I was like, no, you don't. You do not. You do not put Colin Firth in a corner. No, he is Mr. Darcy, and he will always be the best.
He's the OG, huh?
Yep. And there was even some quote when he said, I'm pretty sure I could do anything in my life, and people will still say, oh, Mr. Darcy.
Well, how early in his career was that, 95? Was that like his big breakout thing?
It was his big breakout thing. It definitely, like, it was far from his first. He's been acting since the 80s. I think the first thing I saw him in was A Secret Garden. But it was definitely his breakout.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's tough to kind of, for me to even feel qualified to rate something like this. But I think, especially having learned the stuff that you've illuminated to it now, I was there in like a positive but not glowing, you know, liked it but didn't love it kind of place. But the more I think about just the kind of intricacies and complexities in the characters, I mean, it's tricky because it's a miniseries, but you do, there is a tendency to feel like it took longer than it needed to get where it was. But there's just other stuff happening too. So, and I never felt, like I said, I never felt like it was tedious or overstayed its welcome. I mean, right. It's not something I could, that I watch that often though, you know? So I think I'm inclined to be more critical of the stuff that's more in my wheelhouse. And this is certainly something that's not really, though I do like, you know, some of this, it's tough. I mean, Jane Austen is not Sherlock Holmes, you know, it's not, it's not the same to say like, oh, this British stuff where people are, you know, like sitting in rooms is all, it's not the same stuff. So I think, I don't know, I think I'd have to write it a pretty solid 4 out of 5 for my review of my take of this miniseries. Just to say, yeah, that's a pretty glowing review. That's pretty, I liked it a good bit, and appreciate what it does with the characters, and I think one thing also is that it is pretty funny. It's just, yeah, it's well written, and just about, it's well plotted, and it's well structured.
Yeah.
And you know, the characters are well put together, and so that those things generally are where I arrive. If you get those three things working at a pretty good pace, that then it's in the 4 range. I think it kind of sucks that maybe they didn't have a higher budget in terms, yeah, of just some of the visuals. Like they try to convey that it's Christmassy or snowing a couple times, but it seems like they just kind of spray painted some white on the walls and things. And it always feels like it literally feels like they probably did just shoot this in like 2 months in one, because the scenery is always very similar, and I don't know how much that kind of countryside does change throughout the year, throughout the season, but the story takes place over like a year or something, maybe even more, right?
Right, and it is, but it is England. It's like Seattle. It doesn't,
right, yeah, it doesn't change that much.
Yeah,
yeah, I know. And then you just start to get into other kind of criticisms that aren't valid, where it's like, well, how come it didn't do more in the city? Well, it doesn't take place in the city, you know. It's not what the story is. So yeah, so that's kind of my take. I'm sure you're standing tall, but what's your rating on it?
Absolutely. After 5.
40 times into watching it, or whatever.
After 40 times that I have seen it, I will absolutely give it 5 out of 5. I would say, like you, I give it a 4 out of 4 for the story. Jane Austen is a fantastic writer. She's got this wit. She's got this humor. And the big pump up for me is rewatchability, and clearly I find it very rewatchable, so I'm gonna give it a 5 out of 5.
yeah I mean, I think the miniseries thing helps with that, because there's enough there that, like, you can, like you said, now you can study little things that are happening with side characters, and you can kind of do that. I feel like it's for me, and that's just my own wheelhouse of stuff, there's not enough spectacle for me to necessarily, or like what I like to call mood or whatever, which, right, is just sort of visually stuff, for me to feel like I would could rewatch this like a lot. But I probably could get a kick out of it. It wouldn't be too much of an arm twist if someone's like, hey, I want to watch that, you know, to be like, okay, not like immediately, yeah, but maybe like 3 or 4 years from now.
You know, there's always other Jane Austen out there. We can do Sense and Sensibility. We can do Persuasion, which is, as I've gotten older, my personal favorite.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, like I said, you know more about this stuff than I do. So you guide the way, and we'll take care of it.
All right.
Sounds good. Okay, I got to let the cat in.